Council, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Lamb, and I represent Mr. J. The United States Supreme Court has characterized civil commitment as a massive curtailment of liberty. An individual who is civilly committed may not have the option of refusing unwanted examinations or treatments, which often carry numerous short-term and long-term side effects. In Wisconsin, there is a specific chapter, Chapter 51, that is designed to accommodate short-term commitment and treatment of mentally ill individuals.
So is your argument, your main argument, that JWJ is not a proper subject for treatment because he's so far beyond help that people, they just need to give up?
That is not my argument.
I bet it isn't.
Well, maybe not in those words, but does it boil down to that? That he's just not going to be helped by treatment. They've tried it since at least 1990, and it's not working.
That is part of my argument. My argument is that he has, as you acknowledge, he's been treated for a really long time. And this is the sixth extension of that original commitment that took place in 2009. And the testimony that was presented at the time of this particular commitment, there was testimony that he had no jail contact, that there was no inpatient hospitalizations, there was no testimony that he was, at that point, you know, tried to cheat his medication, tried to avoid the medication. In other words,
the commitment's working, and he's getting treatment, and he's getting help, and he's staying out of the criminal justice system.
That is true, but the argument being is that, you know, these commitments are supposed to be short-term. And so the argument is that the commitment should be vacated. I mean, it's said repeatedly in the case law, it's a short-term commitment. And so it's my position that it's time to end the commitment.
What I read your argument as was I thought it looked like you were asking us to adopt the concurrence in Helen E.F.
I am not asking to adopt a concurrence. What I was hoping was there were some points when I review Helen E.F. that I had questions about, and what I was looking for is hoping that this court would perhaps provide a little bit more clarity on some of the points so that when we get a case like my client, that we're able to determine, myself, opposing counsel, trial courts, that we can better understand whether or not he is in fact a proper subject for treatment. So I noted the concurrence just because I thought the concurrence did make some points or had noted some things that were still left open after Helen E.F. In my opinion, Helen E.F., it's a little bit easier to understand what it really means.
You acknowledged part of Justice Eagler's observation before pivoting to a different part of your argument, that the commitment orders seem to be working in that your client is receiving treatment. The unfortunate, the more violent, the more dramatic symptoms of the mental illness from which he suffers are being kept under control. He's staying out of the criminal justice system. So in what way, other than your observation, which I'm not sure squares with Helen E.F., no one really thought that Alzheimer's was going to lead to a short-term commitment. Other than your general observation that, in your opinion, these should be short commitments, what is wrong with the commitment order in this case?
The problem I have is that there is no end point to this.
Is there any end point to a schizophrenia?
There is not, and that's part of the problem, is he's always going to have schizophrenia. And so he's at the point, once again, you know, where there haven't been problems, and so there needs to be an end to the commitment. It's supposed to be a short term. This is not supposed to be a long-term solution. He's done everything that he needs to do, and so my position is that it's time to give him an opportunity for the commitment to cease or end.
Counsel, what do you think will happen if the treatment stops?
Well, you know, I can't say in the respect that it's speculation. You know, I think it's possible that he could continue seeking treatment. Like I said, there was no evidence presented at this last extension that he had tried to not take the medication.
Counsel, he wouldn't talk to the reviewing doctor. Does that suggest that it bodes well that he would voluntarily continue treatment?
Well, I think that's a difficult question because that is something that we are instructing people that it is their right to decide not to speak to the examining doctors. I think it's certainly, you know, he is entitled to his opinions, and that just goes back to the purpose of a civil commitment. Yeah,
it is his right to not speak to them, but can we not infer from his decision not to speak?
I think that doesn't or shouldn't be one of the considerations, like I said, just because it is a right of his to decide not to speak to the doctor. I don't think that should be held against him when deciding whether or not it's appropriate to commit him or not commit him. Does that answer your question?
What's your best case or statute to support your idea that we should not draw any inference or a court should not draw any inference from a failure to participate in such an interview? And the second part of my question is along the lines of what Justice Kelly was asking you. Does it help you to be able to forecast what might occur, given that the doctors throughout the reports noted that in the past he was non-compliant with his medication, and that's why they had to go to the injectable form so that they could observe him, I think, on a weekly basis, come in and get his medication. So your best case for the idea that we should infer or that the court should infer nothing, is permitted to infer nothing from the failure to cooperate with the interview with the examining psychiatrist, and how should we consider the fact that they had to go to the observable, injectable form of weekly medication because he was non-compliant with his orders otherwise?
So, to address the first question, I would note it is a statutory right that you have the right to counsel. I would have to get back to you, Your Honor, about a particular...
The question wasn't about counsel. You just said right to counsel.
I apologize. The right to remain silent. I would have to get back to you in terms of a case.
Is there a statute on the right to remain silent?
My understanding was that you have the right not to speak to the treating doctor. I believe
sure,
that
and Justice Kelly acknowledged that. His question and my question run to the inference that a court can draw. That's all.
Yes. And so I think that I do not know offhand and have to get back to you about a particular case, but I'd also note, too, that was not something that at least the doctors had testified to at the time of the extension hearing regarding that being one of the reasons for the opinions that they held in that matter. And so moving on, I think, you know, to answer your second question, it's really... Once again, my main point here is that these commitments, they're supposed to be short. It looks like at least at
and
this...
You're relying on Helen E.F. for the proposition that Chapter 51 commitments are supposed to be short-term. Is that correct?
Yes, and I also think that there is support when you look at the actual language of the statute of Chapter 51 versus Chapter 55. I mean, that's where this notion of short-term versus long-term really came from.
Do you think that your client is in need of protective services under Chapter 55 to maintain him on the medications that the record seems to indicate have been helping him, because it appears he may need those long term?
I think that is possible. I can't say definitively, you know, without having a 55 proceeding and the evidence and transcript, but I think that, you know, if this commitment is vacated, I think that he could, there are two ways that this could go forward. You know, he'd get an opportunity to be commitment-free, not under a commitment, or I do think, you know, it is possible that the county could initiate a Chapter 55 proceeding.
He'd need to have a guardian appointed for him under Chapter 55, though, correct?
Yes, and that is one of the benefits when you're talking about long-term issues, is that you do get the opportunity. I think Helen EF talked about how great it was that she had the guardianship, and so there is another person overseeing the commitment. And so,
do you think that your client would benefit from a guardian, or do you think he needs a guardian?
Are you talking about a guardian or, you know, guardian ad litem?
Guardian.
I think that my position is that this is not proper under 51. I think it's possible, once again, that he could need a guardian, that he could be a possible candidate under 55. I can't say definitively without having seen, you know, the evidence and the trial. It's a lot of speculation, but that is an option when you're saying that the 51 is not the appropriate procedure due to, you know, it's supposed to be short term. It's supposed to, the way I understand the statute.
Could you point me to what portion of Chapter 51 you think supports the proposition that it's intended to be shorter term care for the person who is the subject of proceedings under 51?
So, to be clear, there is nothing in the statutory language that says short-term. Where I'm getting this from, as we talked about with Helen EF, but also looking at the language of Chapter 55, which talks about, you know, a permanent disability, talks about long-term support, lifelong duration. And so I think, to me at least, that's how I see these two statutes as functioning as separate ways to enact a civil commitment. And I think that's also supported by, there's a lot of overlap within both of these chapters. I mean, both chapters, they have ways to emergency detention. Both chapters have, you know, an option for admitting this or administering psychotropic medication. And so I really think that supports at least what the court, why there's been a characterization as 51 as being short-term, just because I think if there's long-term, and maybe that's an, you know, it's a little confusing then as how you decide which commitment to proceed under.
Counselor, what concerns me the most is the doctor's opinion that he remains dangerous, either to himself or to others. Is that an appropriate underlying factor for a Chapter 55 proceeding?
In terms of whether or not
his dangerousness, he remains dangerous to himself or others.
So when you look at the protective placement, and just to direct the court's attention to that, under Chapter 5508, in there, one of the criteria is that there may be serious harm. So it would be some type of serious and persistent mental illness resulting in the fact that the individual is so totally incapable of providing for his or own care to create a substantial risk of serious harm or others. And so to answer that question, that is something, you know, that
I think that's a different kind of thing. If you're out of touch with your surroundings and can't provide for your own personal care, that's what you were reading to me about, I'm more concerned about is being actively dangerous, either to himself or to others.
And so I think, you know, once again, Wisconsin, the way the statutes are at least, is it's requiring all three things be met. And I didn't challenge mental illness. I did not challenge dangerousness, which is a different standard on extension. I mean, this is unlike an original commitment where there was some act or overt or something recent. But what I am challenging is proper subject for treatment. And so it seems to me that my client is just not a proper subject for treatment at this point based on the testimony that was presented.
Counsel, let's take a look at treatment then, and that is defined in 51.01 sub 17. Treatment means those psychological, educational, social, chemical, medical, or somatic techniques designed to bring about rehabilitation of the mentally ill, alcoholic, the dependent, or developmentally disabled. Using that definition, make your best argument why your client is not a subject of treatment.
So using that definition, we're looking at the word rehabilitation, which isn't specifically defined, but to me it suggests improving or bettering. And so here I think treatment is just simply serving to maintain. So we're
improving, rehabilitating, bettering what? The underlying condition or the symptoms?
Well, the case law says the symptoms and the disorder. It noted, you know, one of the things that I find a little bit hard to understand is sometimes there's an overlap between someone's behaviors and a symptom. A behavior can be a symptom and vice versa. And so according, you know, what I think makes sense to me is the disorder. So improving the disorder. And, you know, here it's just, like I said, he's kind of being treated now just simply to maintain. There is no more improvement. And that's how I see Chapter 51.
Counsel, there was some improvement to get to this point of being maintained, correct?
Yes.
And without the treatment, he would regress to that prior point, yes?
I don't think we know that for sure right now. I mean, like I said, at the hearing, the evidence was presented over the last course that there wasn't any issues, or there was no evidence at least presented that he wasn't reporting for treatment, that he, you know, was cheeking the meds. None of that is in the record. What we know, I think all we know is that he's stayed out of jail, he's maintained stable housing. And so to me, that means that the 51, I mean, it's done. And the court, I think, finds that he is a proper subject for treatment, I think this, when does this end? I mean, is he going to be committed then under this 51 for the rest of his life, you know, 5, 10 years? Is there a stopping point? And, you know, he's, like I said, he can't do much better than where he's at. And so to me, I think that the commitment under the 51, at least at this point, isn't proper. And
it's not proper because I think, as I understand your argument, there's no progress being made on the treatment of the underlying disorder. I think in answer to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, that's what you said.
Yes, at this point.
Right. And so if there's no... Okay. If there is no improvement, in other words, he's still schizophrenic, and with all of the attendant corollary diagnoses that have been made along with the schizophrenia, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So if he's removed from the treatment that the Chapter 51 provides, when Justice Kelly asked you to forecast the likely result of withdrawal of treatment, if there's no improvement on the underlying disorder, can we not fairly infer that the underlying disorder will remain untreated?
Well, I think the hope is that he would continue, if he chose, to get medication and treatment on his own, and he should have the opportunity to have the commitment vacated for that
even
purpose.
Okay, now it sounds more like you're arguing a factual issue that would have been before the trial court, and the trial court probably would have looked at things such as the order for the administration of pharmaceuticals by injection, where he had to report, I think, on a weekly basis. So I think now it sounds like you're making more of a factual argument.
Yes, that's correct. I am speculating as to what happens. And, you know, I think you bring up a good point. The focus really should be on what happened, what testimony was presented at the trial, and whether or not this was enough for the commitment. And I agree you shouldn't get into this,
so is that
what'll
your, is
happen
that
down the road.
Argument? Is that part of your argument, that there were not enough facts to support, but only if we... I'm trying to understand. You're saying that in order to continue the Chapter 51, the county has to show that there has been an improvement of the underlying disorder.
Yes.
That they're curing schizophrenia.
No, I am not saying that they have to cure. You know, I agree that schizophrenia, it's something, to my knowledge at least, that there is no cure or treatment. What I'm just simply saying is that...
It's like Alzheimer's, unfortunately, right now.
Yes, that's correct. What I'm just simply suggesting is that the county, who has the burden, didn't prove by clear and convincing evidence that he was a proper subject for treatment for the purposes of Chapter 51.
Because
of the fact that there, you know, the testimony suggests that at this point he is simply being maintained, that stabilized, that it's been since 2009, and that there hasn't, you know, he's hit the point where this treatment is no longer going towards improving or bettering the disorder.
Okay.
But it did improve his symptoms or behavior, and that's the problem. I don't know whether it's behavior or symptoms. And when I read your brief, you cite the Athens case dealing with rehabilitable versus habilitative services. You cite CJ, which dealt with the issue of whether you're controlling or curing. Now, you're not curing here. The best you're doing is controlling some of the outward behavior or symptoms of this disease, right? This mental health disease.
Yes. CJ had said that you don't have to cure. You just have to return the person to maybe not even the baseline, but some level of functioning.
And Helen E.F. says, nope, she's not eligible under 51 because Alzheimer's is not going to be fundamentally changed or cured. What might happen is you might affect some of her symptoms, and therefore she comes under Alzheimer's is incurable and untreatable, and only the available medical, this is from Helen E.F., is maintenance, not treatment. And it seemed to me your argument was that this standard was hard to apply in the context of a mental illness, but that if you had to apply Helen E.F., why wouldn't you say, just like Alzheimer's, this is a 55, not a 51?
I think that is, you know, in essence, my argument that
I think is your argument,
under
too.
Both, you know, Helen E.F. and I had found some things that I would propose that the court clarify, but under both standards, that he's not a proper subject for treatment for the purposes of a Chapter 51.
Counsel, I understand your argument on page 13 of your brief. It starts at the last paragraph. The difference between symptoms and behavior is much less clear. And then you give an example. That schizophrenia is characterized by delusions, disorganized speech and behavior, and other symptoms that cause social or occupational dysfunction. Thus, it appears that disorganized behavior is a symptom. So if an individual has schizophrenia and treatment controls the behavior, disorganized behavior, then its treatment is controlling a symptom. Okay. And if it's controlling a symptom, is your argument it doesn't fall under 51 under Helen EF?
I think that the answer is not clear to me, at least under Helen EF. One of the reasons for that was just due to the overlap between behavior and symptoms. I think that Helen EF didn't explicitly state how much of the symptoms. I know they said in for Helen, her it was the vast majority weren't controlled, and so it seemed to me that there was an open question as to what extent these symptoms do in fact need to be controlled. And so that was something, to me at least, that I had hoped that the court could provide a little more clarity going forward.
If we agree with you, or even if we don't, should we remand this to the trial court for the court to consider whether it should be converted to a Chapter 55? I mean, that's one of the dispositions I remember occasionally doing as a trial court judge. Something filed under 51, the case isn't just dismissed. If they're proper subject under 55, you can convert it, and it can become a long-term protective placement type proceeding. Oop, your red light's on. You can address that when you get back up. Thanks.
Counsel, I'm going to also want you to address, how does it benefit your client now, who's not institutionalized, how does it benefit your client to have your argument interpreted that it should be changed from a 51 to a 55? Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Let me first say that I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about this case and the issue. On behalf of Waukesha County, thank you for having me this morning. And I am here representing the people of Waukesha County and the public of Waukesha County in this case. And I would first say that the crux of my argument within my brief and my argument today will be that the test in Helen EF for treatability is working just fine, works fine within the practical application of it and within the law, and should be maintained. And my argument further is that Mr. J is clearly imminently treatable under Chapter 51, and his Chapter 51 commitment should be allowed to continue. And just because a subject plateaus in treatment doesn't mean they're not treatable. What happened in this case, and what happens often with paranoid schizophrenics, and I point out that in the case law, every case that we have, and there aren't many, I can see that, but every case we have that's not LNEF is a paranoid schizophrenic case. Athens and Haskins were paranoid schizophrenics. CJ was a paranoid schizophrenic. And Mr. J, in our case, is a paranoid schizophrenic. And what occurred in our case, and what occurs often in terms of the course of treatment for a paranoid schizophrenic, and it's played out in the testimony of Dr. Kwok in our case, is a person goes into forced treatment. And that happened in Mr. J's case. He started forced treatment, and he improved. We know he improved because he got discharged from an inpatient setting to an outpatient setting. And that doesn't happen unless you show improvement.
Yeah, but should this go on for 6 years, 10 years, 12? I mean, at what point should it either A, be converted to a 55, or B, the person should have a chance to live on their own?
The difficulty with the, well, first of all, there's two answers to that question, and I'll give you both of them. The first answer is, yes, it should go on as long as the person meets criteria under 51. And the second answer is, there are limitations within 55, and I practice in both areas of law. There are limitations within 55 that are not, that don't exist within 51. The primary limitation is there's no ability to treat on an inpatient psychiatric unit in Chapter 55. It only exists in Chapter 51. And in fact, the statute in 55 says that the placement locations for a person excludes facilities for the acutely mentally ill. So we know we can't put a person in a locked psychiatric setting under Chapter 55, even if they need that setting. The second limitation is that you have to be generally incompetent, not just incompetent as to medications, which is generally the case in Chapter 51. We often have people, and Mr. J is one of those people, who can't either express the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives of medication, or apply that understanding to his own situation. So he's incompetent in that limited sphere of not being able to understand that he needs medication to treat his mental illness, and that he should take that medication. But he's not generally incompetent. And you have to be incompetent to qualify for a 55, because before you get the 55, you have to have a guardian of the person, and before you can have a guardian of the person, you have to be incompetent.
And Chapter 55 does not contemplate having a person who has been found to be dangerous to himself or others. Is that correct?
Within the, if you were to seek a medications order as a protective service, it does. But within the general chapter, what it essentially contemplates in practice is a person who doesn't meet that level of dangerousness. The standard is that essentially that a person cannot care for self, and the harm to others is really an example. Someone who shouldn't be driving anymore, who runs their car into someone else's car because they're suffering from dementia and they don't have safety awareness. And so there is some I would agree with counsel that there's some overlap between these statutes, but there's some pretty specific limitations.
The finding of dangerousness with respect to Mr. J by the trial court does not restrict him to Chapter 51, then?
It does not.
Is there any other mechanism other than Chapter 51 proceedings or Chapter 55 proceedings that could ensure that Mr. J continues to receive medication?
No.
Counsel, in 1972, this state had a sea change in its mental health law in the Lessard decision. One of the components of the federal courts calling our statute unconstitutional was that psychiatric evidence was able to be admitted without the person being advised of the privilege against self-incrimination. Subsequently, Wisconsin has in its statutes 5101(9)(a)(4) that admonition that the potential committee has to be advised that they may remain silent. What's the law? Can there be an inference regarding that silence if against the potential committee if he exercises that right?
Your Honor, I've never seen case law on that issue. I don't believe. If there's case law on that issue specific to 51, I'm not aware of it.
I mean, I think maybe more to the point, if a treating physician is there and he's making the observations about the non-cooperation, may the treating physician include that in his or her calculus as to the treatability issue?
I think in practical terms they do. And remember, that happens in one of two ways. When a person's locked in a psychiatric institution and a doctor goes to see them...
I'm sorry, I missed that. When a person what?
Is in a psychiatric institution and a doctor goes to see them. If they're detained under 51,
yes,
and they're inpatient, a doctor goes to visit them to do the examination and evaluation, they are essentially a captive audience. And so the doctor will have the ability to at least observe them, even if the person doesn't interact with the doctor. However, when a person is being treated on an outpatient basis, as Mr. J is, what happens is the doctor attempts to contact them by phone and or by letter and says, the court has appointed me to examine you, and I would like to meet with you. And that's what happened in this case. And Mr. J said no. So the doctor had no opportunity to observe Mr. J. What's interesting in the statute that was pointed out is that the statute doesn't say the person can refuse to meet. The statute says the person can remain silent. But the way that's applied in practical terms in the field every day is that if the person says, I'm not going to meet with you, then a meeting doesn't occur. And so do doctors, when they observe patients, draw inferences by that refusal? Of course they do, because they draw inferences on everything the patient does. That's what they're trained to do.
You know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You hit on something when Justice Eagler asked you a question, and you mentioned in passing, and I'd like you to talk about it just a little bit more, that one of the distinctions between the chapters 51 and 55 is that in 55 there's no provision for any locked facilities. And I recall the late Justice Crooks, he didn't write about it, but I think at oral argument in Helen EF, he mentioned his personal concern over an aunt or some elderly relative of his who suffered from dementia or Alzheimer's, and he had a very real concern over someone suffering from Alzheimer's being placed in a locked facility. What's the distinction here? Is the concern the same or is it different? What should we be thinking about that?
To be clear, what Chapter 55 says is you cannot place a person in a facility for the acutely mentally ill.
That's right.
And that those facilities are locked.
Yes.
But those facilities are locked.
You also can place a Chapter 55 person in a locked portion of
You can.
I mean, you issue orders, I don't want to say with frequency, but as a circuit court judge, it's not unusual to issue an order that indicates that it'll be on a locked unit. That's the phraseology oftentimes that's used.
But that's true, but the difference between that unit and an inpatient psychiatric unit is pretty significant. I mean, it's significant in terms
allocation.
It's pretty significant in terms of the population, and it's pretty significant in terms of the types of care that's offered there.
Counsel, one of my concerns deals with duration. And Chapter 51 seems to be uniquely focused on time limits and short time limits, and you know, you've got to keep this moving. If I recall, 48 hours, you've got the initial detention, you have to have a preliminary hearing. That might have changed, but that's my understanding. Then how many days before a final hearing? Is it 14 or how many days?
It's 72 hours from physical custody and detention to probable cause hearing.
Okay.
14 days from physical custody to final hearing.
Then, of course, you have reviews. And so there's just a lot of deadlines that have to be met and quickly, you know. And that's been in our statutes for quite some time. Chapter 51, to me, seems equipped for long-term cases.
Justice, I would argue that it depends on the long-term case, and this is why. When I began my remarks, what I said was that Mr. J has benefited from treatment and began to improve. And I would concede that at some point he plateaued. And even in the doctor's remarks, Dr. Koch's remarks, what he said was that Mr. J has received a benefit from treatment. And what I said was he was inpatient, now he's out. I would point out to the court that the record reflects Mr. J lives in the community essentially independently as a result of this treatment. The record also reflects, and Mr. J directly stated to Dr. Koch, and this is in Dr. Koch, in the transcript of Dr. Koch's testimony, Mr. J believes that his schizophrenia causes his psychiatric symptoms. It is the worst kind of the inability to grasp that the medications are actually, his stability is a result of the medications that he takes. And because of that, there is no way he is ever going to accept medications on a voluntary basis. And because he's not going to accept medications on a voluntary basis, we're going to have this. So he started, he improved, he's plateaued, his symptoms are under control. So the definition in Helen EF, when I told you that I thought it works as a practical matter, if the symptoms can be controlled or improved, the illness or the symptoms, then you're treatable. Well, first they were improved, and now they're controlled. But as soon as we stop that medication, they're going to be what is not in control, and that is out of control.
Counsel, can I talk to you a little bit about what Justice Bradley was just discussing with you? My recollection also is that there's a pretty quick turnaround when a subject initially comes in. You have the initial hearing, the probable cause hearing, but then there's a little cool down period, the 14 days where they can you know, be treated, and sometimes that person comes back a very different person after 2 weeks. I mean, you don't even recognize the person. They're so much better. Sometimes not, but sometimes. Then the way the procedure goes is there's the final determination and disposition of the matter, but then it just doesn't languish out there. There's another turnaround period, but it's not 72 hours and it's not 14 days. It's 6 months, I think, when they come back in for a court review. So again, we're sort of on, initially, a real fast track, 2 weeks, a little longer track, then 6 months before they come back to visit with the court again, right?
That's correct.
Then the statutes call for a year commitment. I mean, from that period forward, it's lengthy. I mean, compared to 72 hours, 14 days, and 6 months, the recommitments are for a year. What, if anything, do you think that speaks to as far as this? I mean, in a way, it argues against this being a short-term thing. If it were a short-term thing, they'd make it shorter rather than continuing to extend the time periods for recommitment. What do you think of that?
Thank you. The first thing I would say is that I think the reason between the six-month initial term of commitment, which you correctly cite, and then the year of what we call recommitment or extension of commitment, is that a person may recover or improve pretty quickly within that initial period. And if they require extension or recommitment after that six-month term, then the legislature saw fit to make that next term a year and have that review if it's necessary to continue a person on commitment on an annual basis. I would point something out in the statute that I think is noteworthy, and it's the difference between 5120, the mental health statute, and 5145, the alcohol statute.
Mm-hmm.
The mental health statute has no limitation within it about how many times a person's commitment can be extended or they can be recommitted. The 5145 alcohol statute does. The alcohol statute allows for one commitment of 90 days and one extension for 6 months, and that's it. You're gone.
You must be reading my mind. I was wondering why the legislature didn't do that if this was supposed to be a short term.
I believe that you have to construe the statute to think that the legislature did it on purpose. That they believe that there may be instances like this case and generally that individuals benefit from treatment, and even if you're, and I can't stress this enough, if you're plateaued in treatment, you've come from a place where you are much worse off than you are now. You're now in a place, and in Mr. J's case, it's very telling. You're in a place where you're being treated involuntarily, absolutely. Mr. J requires involuntary treatment, and I concede that, and I make no bones about that. That's what we do. But he gets that treatment by receiving a long-acting injectable, and he gets that injectable on a monthly basis. And he doesn't live in a group home. He doesn't live in an adult family home or a CVRF, community-based residential facility. He lives in an apartment by himself.
Okay.
He's able to be maintained in that setting.
I recognize that whatever is being done to him medically is enabling him to live independently. But what I want to know from you is, how does his basic medical condition, that is, that he's schizophrenic, differ from Alzheimer's so that you reach one result in Helen F., EF, and another result here?
The very basic and fundamental difference is you can positively affect the illness and its symptoms when you have paranoid schizophrenia, even chronic paranoid schizophrenia, but you cannot do that with dementia.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, depending on what stage of Alzheimer's you're in. You can change some of the behavior so that it is improved.
Which is different than a symptom.
Well, that's getting to my point. I don't know that behavior and symptom are different. I'd like you to define it, because to me, if you look at Helen EF, it says that you're not, that it's not treatable, that it's going to be the same and you're not treating the underlying issue. And therefore, it's a 55, not a 51. And I'm looking at page 16 of Ms. Land's brief, where she modifies Helen EF. What's the matter with the modification? What it does, in effect, is says that if you can't improve the disorder, and here, if you can't improve the schizophrenia, and you don't, I mean, you don't change it, that's still there, then the subject doesn't have rehabilitative potential and is not a proper subject of, for treatment. That would, with, you heard the definition and know the definition of treatment. However, this is under the modification. If treatment will go to improving the disorder, then the subject individual has rehabilitative potential. What's the matter with that definition?
If I might, I'd like to answer both your questions in turn. Your first question was about symptoms and behavior.
That's right.
And neither is defined in 51. However, if you look at the Merriam-Webster, I went all the way back to that, the Merriam-Webster definition.
We like dictionary definitions.
So the symptoms, subjective evidence of disease or physical disturbance. Behavior, the manner of conducting oneself. I think there's a pretty substantial difference between those two.
Yeah, except that the manner of behaving oneself or acting can be evidence of the disease.
Correct. And
so, they overlap.
You're absolutely right, but the
I
way
generally
you get
am.
I'm sorry?
I said I, never mind.
Go ahead.
I said I generally am. Go ahead.
Thank you. The way you get there is you start with an illness, which causes symptoms.
Right.
Which causes behavior.
Right.
So if your illness is paranoid schizophrenia and you suffer from paranoia and your paranoia causes you to believe that your brother is trying to hurt you, so your behavior is that you act out and batter him. The behavior is the battery. The symptom is the paranoia. And to answer your second question...
So where does that get you under the Helen EF definition or the statutory definition of treatment?
Right. And so what is lost in the proffered change to the standard? Because the proffered change is we should just use improve and we shouldn't use control. What is lost is you lose what you've done so far when we've improved the illness from the time that the patient was not treated. Because I would concede that at this point, Mr. J's illness is not being further improved. He has plateaued. However, that in and of itself, that control is treatability. Because his illness is being controlled. If you look at Dr. Koch's testimony, Dr. Koch indicates that when Mr. J is not on medications, he has demand hallucinations to harm himself or others. When he is on medication, the symptoms may still be present, but he does not act on them. And the reason that's telling is that in and of itself is treatment that is positively affecting this patient in a practical way. Here's the other practical reality. If Mr. J was not being involuntarily treated, he would be in a psychiatric setting, inpatient. We know that because historically that's where he's been. But because he's being involuntarily treated, he's able to be treated in the least restrictive setting consistent with his needs, which is what 51 requires us to do.
Counsel, is least restrictive. I want to focus on that. And do you consider Chapter 55 commitment to be less restrictive than a 51 commitment?
It depends on the type of Chapter 55 commitment in the placement setting. So it could be. It could be less restrictive than a 51. But remember, too, in 55, in order to get there, you now have a guardian. In 51, if you're a committed patient under Chapter 51 and you're being treated in an outpatient setting, you're essentially making all your own decisions except that of medication if you have a medications order. If you're under a Chapter 55 commitment, you have a guardian that's making all your decisions, or at least many of them. I recognize that guardianship can be tailored.
Yeah. Medical decisions are financial, too.
If I may, excuse me. That's exactly, again, going back to the Lessard decision. Our statutory scheme didn't require the least restrictive alternative. Now it's required under statute, the least restrictive alternative. If in certain situations a Chapter 55 is less restrictive, then shouldn't there be a conversion, and why shouldn't there be a conversion here?
Because in a lot of instances, including this one, the subject doesn't meet criteria for a Chapter 54 or a Chapter 55. We can't do a conversion. It would be great if we could say 51 doesn't apply and we're automatically going to apply 55, but I'll tell you that in instances where a person is released from a Chapter 51 commitment for whatever reason, and they still require, be that reason a technical reason or a legal reason, where they still require treatment, we don't automatically put them in a 54 or 55 proceeding because they don't qualify for it. You have to be incompetent. And to answer Justice Bradley's question about the difference between having a guardian of the person and a guardian of the estate, you can have one or both. You need to have a guardian of the person for a Chapter 55. You can have one without the other, but you cannot have a protective placement order without a guardianship of the person. So by the time you get to that protective placement order, you now have someone making some or all of your personal decisions, your care decisions, your medical decisions. To me, that's much more restrictive than an order under Chapter 51, despite the fact that the order under Chapter 51 may require you to take medications against your will.
How would you, I'm sorry, did you want to ask a question, Justice?
No, mine was answered, thank you.
That's pretty nifty when you can have your question answered without even fully asking it.
Right. You did a good job, counsel. Would you make any change in the language quoted at page 16 from Helen E.F.? Would you make any change to Helen E.F. standard you would not.
I would not.
And so if you were to draft this opinion, tell me again how you would differentiate this fact, this mental illness against the Alzheimer's disease.
It's treatable.
The symptoms are treatable, or the behavior is treatable.
The symptoms are treatable, and the illness can either be improved or controlled.
And I think what you're referring to is on paragraph 37 of Helen E.F., where the court noted, this is so because given the current state of medical science, Helen, an 85-year-old Alzheimer's victim, Helen's Alzheimer's disease is incurable and untreatable. Here, the testimony is that fortunately for Mr. J, his schizophrenia is treatable. I think that's what you're referring to.
It is, and Justice Abramson, you asked how I knew it was treatable, and we know it's treatable because a doctor who is an expert in psychology said it was treatable, and we know it's treatable because this patient has been able to be stabilized to the point that he can be treated in a less restrictive setting.
Would you deal more with the difference between symptom and behavior if you were writing an opinion?
I think that it isn't absolutely necessary to make that differentiation. I think that in my experience, the people who practice in this area and the doctors who practice in this area understand the difference between behavior and symptom.
Well, don't you think it's important that the lawyers understand it and that the person that's being subject to Chapter 51 or 55 understand it?
Well, certainly any time there can be clarity brought to a issue, there's always good in that.
So do you think it needs clarity in terms of symptom and behavior?
I would recognize that if all you're doing is controlling behavior, you're not treating an illness. If what you're doing is controlling or improving the symptoms and the illness itself, you are treating an illness.
So you think that under Helen EF, you have to treat the illness?
And or the symptoms.
If the pharmaceutical industry hypothetically developed medication that was capable of treating the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, would someone suffering from Alzheimer's be potentially appropriate for services under Chapter 51 or a Chapter 51 commitment?
Well, that was left open in Helen EF specifically, well, right?
Theoretically, yes, but the difference is that if that person is incompetent, so if you're suffering from Alzheimer's dementia or any kind of dementia to the point at which you become incompetent, you no longer can make decisions for yourself, then you may be more appropriate for Chapter 55 because you likely need a guardian. And Chapter 55 does allow for for placement, not in a psychiatric setting, and it does allow for treatment with psychotropic medications. It's a different process, but it allows it. But it doesn't allow the inpatient psychiatric treatment that a person needs when they're being treated under Chapter 51, at least initially.
And in this case, Mr. J has not been found to be incompetent.
He has not.
Counsel, Helen EF says one has rehabilitative potential. The treatment will go to controlling the disorder and its symptoms.
Right.
Does it require that we find that both the schizophrenia, the underlying disorder, and the symptoms are being controlled? And if so, how do you tell the difference between the disorder being controlled and the symptoms being controlled?
If the question is if Helen EF requires it, I would say that when you're controlling symptoms, you're controlling the disorder.
So
you essentially, Justice, you know it when you see it. I mean, if a person is suffering from paranoid schizophrenia and they're having demand hallucinations, and those hallucinations either cease or become less severe, you're clearly treating the illness because we're not talking about the behavior that the hallucinations cause. We're talking about the hallucinations themselves. And so you're treating the illness there, and that's certainly true in this case.
Right, and the comprehensive section of paragraph 36 in Helen EF, which Justice Kelly was referring to, says, however, if treatment will, and we quote from one of the Court of Appeals cases that we were trying to reconcile, if treatment will go beyond controlling activity and will go to controlling the disorder and its symptoms, then the subject individual has rehabilitative potential and is a proper subject for treatment. And here in Helen EF, we compared the situation of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's victim with that of a more traditional subject of a Chapter 51 individual. I think that's what you were referring to when you responded to Justice Kelly.
Can I respond? My light is on.
Yes, briefly, please.
Thank you. That was what I was referring to. Thank you. Thank you all.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
So I was left with two questions, and I'd like to first address those questions. So first of all, Justice Ziegler, I know you asked me about converting. The statute is 5120.
I've got it.
Oh, got it.
Thanks. And the other one, 5129A4, is the one where the doctor has to tell the person, you have the right to remain silent, but I still have to do a report.
Yes. And Justice Bradley, you had asked me whether, you know, what were the benefits. And I think that one of the benefits that came out, according to Attorney Miller, is in fact that there is no acute psych ward when you are under a 55. And so I think that to some people would in fact be beneficial compared to the 51.
There's a trade-off, and he explained the trade-off in his comments where he's not sure it's less restrictive in all situations because you have a guardian of the person.
Yes, that's correct. I also wanted to begin by noting that it's my understanding that the county is conceding that there is no improvement, that he has plateaued. And so it's my position then, applying the Helen EF standard, that because there is no improvement, that my client is not a proper subject for treatment under there.
Had Helen EF plateaued because of any treatment that was being administered to her?
I don't think that was the term used in Helen EF, or at least from my reading of the case, they were saying that her disorder could not
that unfortunately, given the current state of medical science, Alzheimer's is not treatable.
Yes, and that's my understanding. And so I think this case is...
So she had plateaued simply as a product of the progression of her disease. And I don't know that the word plateaued was there. It was, no one thought that plateau was going to remain on a straight line, right? I mean, there was only one way for Helen, and that was going to be down.
Yes, that's my understanding. And so I think one of the...
Counsel, plateauing is not really the determinative factor if withdrawal of the treatment would cause the person to regress, right? If it did cause the person to regress, then what we do is we look at where the person currently is versus where they would be without the treatment. And if the delta justifies treatment, then that satisfies the standard. Isn't that correct?
You know, I think that, to me, if I'm understanding you, Justice, that also wraps in a little bit the standard for dangerousness, whether or not somebody would be a proper subject for, commitment mistreatment is resolved. I mean, my position with a proper subject for treatment is just whether or not this is improving the disorder. And so I'd argue here that is not what's happening. I would also, one of the things I'd like to just note was when you look at
it. I want to make sure I understand your position here correctly. Are you saying that if we knew to metaphysical certainty that this person would decline in symptoms or the control of the disorder without treatments, but just because it's not getting better, that we can say this person is not a proper subject for treatment, even though we know that he would be worse off without the current treatment he's getting?
I think, that goes more to the dangerous, whether or not the person is dangerous. I think that whether or not there's treatment, I think we're just simply looking at the disorder. We're not taking into consideration, a person's actions or feelings towards the medication. And so going back to my other point, I would just note as well that the specific testimony at the time of the proceeding from the doctor was that his behavior is improved and he can survive in the community. And so to me, that supports the argument that he is not a proper subject for treatment, because once again, we're talking about behavior. That's what was testified. We're not at all talking about the actual disorder. But
that determination could only be possible because his symptoms had improved. In other words, your opposing counsel used that fact to draw the very opposite inference that you're drawing, that say, look, because of all of the intense services, medical and I suppose other services that were provided, he is able to live on his own. He is able. Therefore, the treatment is working. The symptoms, he's not just being maintained at a current level. He has come up from being not incarcerated, but kept involuntarily, so now he can live on his own in an apartment. So that's your argument. That's one of your arguments against continuing Chapter 51 supervision?
May I answer my red?
Yes, you may answer briefly.
Thank you. Yes, it's my position that 51 is no longer appropriate. It has been approved, and now all treatment is doing is maintaining, and so therefore, for that reason, the commitment should be vacated.
Treatment is maintaining his improvement. Treatment is maintaining his improved status.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank you very much. These cases are always very difficult because of the rights of the person who is being treated and the rights of those that live around him with or without the treatment. So thank you very much. We're going to take a brief recess now so we